right. Brent, how's this? All right. Brent told me one time about how to hold the mic. He says everybody does it wrong. So, not everybody speaks here. He says just everybody holds a mic. Sorry, Brent. Didn't mean to blow you up there. Good evening. Going to be talking this evening about the church at Smyrna. I am very nervous. I'm never nervous about speaking. I have no problem public speaking, but teaching always makes me nervous and exposing myself to what Paul called the greater judgment. Steve and I were talking about that. Kelsey and I were talking about that earlier. So I'm always nervous about teaching the word. So hopefully the Holy Spirit will guide me and the Lord will let his words go forth and I will not interrupt him too terribly. For those of you who are here on Sunday, how many people were here on Sunday? Most everybody? Okay. There was a sermon on Sunday called Getting Our Goat that matches almost perfectly with the way with this letter and the way we're going to speak about it tonight. So you guys have already heard most of most of the vein of what we're going to be talking about, essentially about receiving an unpleasant prophecy that is Daniel chapter 8, I believe. The ram and the goat. It's an unpleasant one to receive, but with faith and with a deeper look at it, we can uncover the hidden sweetness. So Smyrna, the second church, as you all remember, that these are addressed in the order of a great big loop running through Asia Minor, Turkey. If you think Turkey, that's where it's at. You hit the coast coming in from Patmos. You come into a place called Ephesus, and then you head straight north from there, and you wind up at Smyrna. It's a seaport, large city, quite wealthy, was never a capital, but became more important in this time, and then as time went on, it became a very very rich town. This letter is very simple. It's very direct. It is, aside from the opening and closing framing, which is present in every letter, this letter basically has 2 points. And it is the shortest letter at 4 verses. And for those of you who are interested, the longest is Thyatira at 12. So some of you all are probably wondering, hey, with only 4 verses, he probably can't talk that long, can he? And that's why I gave you an outline, by the way. So as you're wondering, man, how much longer is he going to talk? You got an outline, so you can tell where. Although I reserve the right, and I usually do, to skip things as we kind of, I'm pretty good at watching the clock, so I may skip a few things, or I may add some things in, because in this letter, short as though it is, there is a ton of doctrine. This letter can be discussed, and the various points about it, almost endlessly. We could have quite a time following just the Catholic teachings alone, becoming more and more esoteric as we move further and further afield. But we're going to try not to do that too much tonight. We're going to start off in the text itself, the golden road of the biblical text. Then we'll kind of move into the paved road of our applications, and a little bit more into maybe some gravel when we're talking about the implications, that is what we can look at internally about the letter, and then we'll head out into the swamp of extrapolating what we find in this letter into various points. So to begin with, this letter is short enough, let's just read it straight through. And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, the words of the first and the last who died and came to life. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. Oh, excuse me. So the opening and closing framing, that is verses 8 and 11, and to the angel of the church of Smyrna write, and so each one of the 7 letters begins that way, to the angel of such and such write, the words of, and then a characteristic of Jesus. So that's the opening framing, and the closing framing is the same as it is for the other letters. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches, and then a small summary message of comfort or warning or promised reward. So, what does this letter actually say? To begin with, you guys are doing great, and I have a reward waiting for you. Your reward is already extant. It is already here. It is waiting on you because you are already rich, and your reward is laid up for you. And soon, you are going to suffer. Now, the Greek suffer is, tribulation is thlipsis. It's pressure, pressing, pushing. When you combine that with the directive that comes after, be faithful unto death, that to me implies that death will come after. You're going to have this pressure put upon you for 10 days, and then death comes after that. Possibly that means that some of them will be executed after being in jail for a time. I am a pessimist and also a very fearful man, and I have always interpreted that this means that you're going to be tortured to death. That's a sobering thought, isn't it? I am somewhat of a historical researcher of torture because it terrifies me, and I learn about things that scare me. And we as human beings have no end of some of the horror. I'm not going to share any details of that tonight, because if you don't know it, then the Lord bless you in your ignorance. But we can think of horrible things to do to each other. That makes this quite the sobering letter. However, after that comes the reward, specifically the reward of a crown. The crown is the symbol of a kingship. The crown is the symbol of the conqueror. When we take a look at the rider on the first white horse, the opening of the first seal, he wears many crowns to show that he has had many victories. This crown is the symbol of victory. As a matter of fact, the word crown in the Greek is Stephanos, where we get the name Stephen. And it actually is, crown is one word for it, but another word for it is garland or laurel or wreath. And if you think back to the old Olympic Games, where the winner would be crowned with the laurel, would be crowned with the wreath, this is not really a reward in and of itself, because the old laurel wasn't. The crown that God gives certainly is, but the old laurel wasn't. What it was is a way to designate you, to make you stand out, to make you say, oh, look at that guy. That guy's the champion. And so it seems that this reward after this martyrdom will be greater, or will be made to stand out even, than the reward of the others who make it to heaven. There is some indication from Paul, especially in 1 Corinthians, I believe it's in chapter 3, about different levels of works, different levels of rewards, and the trial by fire, and the ones that stand, and the ones that do not. He is not very specific about it, and I cannot give you a further interpretation. I can't tell you, you know, that it's, oh yes, there's 10 levels of reward, and you're a 3, and you're a 7, and you're not. We don't have that kind of detail. The only thing that we have is that there does seem to be some type of gradation. The greater, the lesser. Jesus often talked about the first, last, last, first. There does seem to be some type of leveling to our reward. And this reward will be greater than the others. Paul talked about building with gold, building with silver, building with jewels, building with wood, building with straw. And he said some of our works, the foundation being Jesus Christ, go back and read 1 Corinthians 3 if you like. The foundation being Jesus Christ, those who build, basically our lives, our deeds will be tried as through fire. And this, staying faithful unto death, this is building with gold. This is the highest reward. This is the laurel. This is the crown. In summary, you're doing great. Your reward is waiting. Soon comes trouble. Stay faithful. Pretty simple, isn't it? Boil it down, it's 2 points. You're doing great. Trouble's coming. What is missing from this letter? It's missing from this letter and the letter to the church in Philadelphia. But it's not present in these. And all the others, not this. A rebuke. Excellent, Jones. A correction. There isn't one in this letter. This is one of the only two where Jesus seems to have only positive things to say. Depending on how you interpret the phrase, but you are rich. I interpret it to mean that he is comforting them, that he's being sympathetic to them. There are other interpretations that say he's reprimanding them, as in don't think that you're poor because you're actually rich. I choose to believe that there is no reprimand for them. The worthy Church of Smyrna is one of only two with no reprimand. So I think we can be proud of our brothers and sisters in Smyrna. 2,000 years, well, not 2,000 years dead, 2,000 years alive, truly living, 2,000 years in their reward. Bless them for the example that they provide to us. So, who does this letter apply to? I put two notes in there, the Once and Future Church and the Pilgrim's Progress. Those are both plays on names of books, so that means I can't mock Pastor anymore for his love of alliteration, since I was quite delighted with myself when I came up with these. So I'm just as ridiculous, probably more so. It's a play on a book title called The Once and Future King, about King Arthur, about a king who was and will be again. That this letter applies to a church that was and will be again. Pastor talks Sunday about the ripple effect of prophecy, how it comes true again and again and again. This story of a persecution, I have no doubt, came true for the Church of Smyrna. There was no end to the persecutions of the church in this day under Nero. This letter was written under the time probably of Domitian. As a matter of fact, the guy writing this letter, John the Revelator, is writing it in exile from an island in Patmos. So certainly the idea of being thrown into jail, certainly the idea of being tortured, certainly the idea of being executed, this was not an uncommon thing for the church that this is specifically addressed to, Smyrna, or to the church of that day, the early church, or to the church of today. We are not the rule here in America. We are the exception. Though our freedoms are not what they were, or perhaps what they should be, we have, in that regard, very little room to complain. It is not unheard of if you are leading a church in China, or in Africa, or in places in the Middle East. It is not at all uncommon for you to be dragged out and thrown into jail. It is not at all uncommon for you to suffer for the name of God and for your faith, or to lose your life. I would say that the church today, this prophecy applies to quite well. And then, of course, the end times church. There is an idea floating around, that different letters, these seven letters, apply to different ages of the church. I don't think that's actually true. However, I will say this does strike me as an especially end times church. Because during the end times, during the Great Tribulation, as Jesus said, if those days were not shortened, there would no flesh remain. When we come to the end times, there will certainly be a pressing on the church. It behooves us to pay especial attention to this letter, to all the letters, but especially to this letter, because this is the letter that we know is coming. This type of persecution is coming. Maybe today, maybe tomorrow, soon, and for the rest of our lives. As a movie quote, if anybody knows. And the Pilgrim's Progress. So we know that this applies to the past church. We know it applies to the present church. We know it will apply to the future church. It doesn't just apply to the church. It applies to us individually in each of our lives. The Pilgrim's Progress is the story of a Christian life. It's about a guy who travels on a road to the kingdom of heaven and has different allegorical adventures and meets people named things like worldly wise man and pope and pagan and help and faithful and hopeful. And it's just an allegory about living a Christian life. Oh, and by the way, the entire road that he travels is one huge trial. Towards the beginning of his journey, he's given an armor and a sword, and he needs it almost the whole time. There are some instances where he's at rest, but most of the time he's either fighting from someone, running from someone, or trying to keep himself from wandering off the road, as is his life, as is my life, as is I'm sure many of you as well. That's just the story of a Christian life. In other words, you might say that you could say to any of us in our lives that you're doing great, hopefully, but trouble is coming. Trouble is always coming. We're either under a trial, getting ready for a trial, or just got finished with a trial. And it will be that way till the day we die. Great example for that, if you're looking for evidence other than just your own lived experience. Man, I got to pick up the speed. 1 Peter 4, "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you as though some strange thing happened to you." Peter's basically saying, hey, when you hit trouble, when you run into stuff, don't be surprised. That's what was in store for you. Oh, that's a beautiful sound. However, just a quick note from the Pilgrim's Progress. As Christian, that's the name of the main character, his name is Christian, as he goes down this road, he has two guys that journey with him. The first one is a guy named Faithful, and the second guy is a guy named Hopeful. Faithful makes it about halfway down the road to a place called Vanity Fair, where he's put on trial and burned at the stake. And then a chariot comes, he is loaded up, his renewed body, and he goes straight to heaven, gets to skip the whole second half of the journey, headed straight to his glorious reward, not unlike those who might suffer the persecution and the death that is prophesied in this letter. Can everyone still hear me? I know that rain's kind of loud. Can everyone still hear me that wants to? Let's put it that way. A little louder? All right. In summary, this letter applies to the church of the day, it applies to the modern day church, it applies to the church of the future, and it applies to our own lives. A rather important letter, one might say. So let's look at what meanings we can draw from the text of the letter itself. There are a bunch. This list that I have has cut down a lot. But this is just a few of the things we can draw from it. And I'm hoping to leave a lot of time for you guys because I'd like to hear what you have to say too. First of all, the sympathy and comfort of poverty. Jesus says to them, now this is in verse 9, "I know your tribulation and your poverty and the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not." I know what you're going through. To know, Eido, E-I-D-O, is to grasp the substance of, is the implication of the word, to fully understand. If perfect sympathy is fully knowing what someone else is going through, Jesus has perfect sympathy. He says, "I know your tribulation. I know your poverty." Sometimes we forget that. We forget that we pray to God, "God, don't you know I'm suffering? Don't you know I'm frustrated? Don't you know I'm hot and I'm tired and there's cracks in the foundation and I don't have enough money and my kids are a mess? And don't you know all this?" Look at this. I know. He says, "I am there with you. I grasp fully the situation that you are in." And he has comfort for them, the same he has comfort for us. He tells them, "You are rich." He does not say you will be rich. He does not say that you will receive this reward. He says, "You are rich. Your reward already exists. It's sitting right here." This lines up with what Jesus tells us. "Store up treasures in heaven," Matthew 6. "Do not store them here on the earth where," "moth and rust corrupt, where thieves can break in and steal. Store them up in heaven." And that's what Jesus is telling these saints. He's telling them, you already have your reward. You have already earned it. It is already in your name. Now, first thing I want to know is, how can I do the same? I want him to tell me that I'm rich. I want him to tell me that I already have a great reward. Well, the way I can do that is by following the example of these saints, by bearing up under privation, under tribulation, under trouble, and staying faithful, and being cheerful, and not being corrupted. Notice he doesn't have to say to them, "Hey, lift up your hearts." He doesn't have to say to them, "Hey, return to your first love." He doesn't have to say to them, "Don't tolerate those sins that you're tolerating." It's up to me to do the same. I'll go through tribulations in my life. I hope not as bad as what they're going to go through. But I need to stay true to my doctrine. I need to be cheerful, be an example, and continue to serve. And hopefully hear also the words, you are rich, Pete. Let's drop down to this next uncomfortable. Who feels comfortable reading that next point? The inevitable victory of evil. Who feels good about hearing that? Pastor talked a great deal about this on Sunday, about it's not a true victory, it's not an eternal victory. Christ will always be the ultimate victor. By the way, who here knows what ultimate means? Ultimate actually means last. A lot of people, the way we use it and the way a lot of people think of it, they think it means best or biggest or greatest. Ultimate actually means last. So when we say Jesus will be the ultimate victor, we mean that he will be the last. His victory will be eternal. After him, there will be no other victors. His will last forever, and we shall share with it. So the victory of evil will not stand, yet they will have a victory temporarily in the flesh against these Christians, because the word that Jesus uses, about to, what you are about to suffer, by the way, who would love to hear that read in a letter? Guy stands up to read the letter of the church, and yeah, I know your poverty, but you're rich. And you're thinking, yeah, don't be afraid of what you're about to suffer. Let's say what now? About to, mellow, M-E-L-L-O, although the Greek, I'm sure, is Omicron, Epsilon, however it goes. Mellow, on the point of happening. It has been decided. This is going to happen. In brief, there will be a time for the victory of evil. The forces of this world will have occasional victories. We talked Sunday about Antiochus Epiphanes. There'll be the Great Tribulation at the end times, and there will be the suffering of these saints at Smyrna. There will be setbacks. There will be failures. But we need to remain faithful through them, knowing that in the end, Jesus will be the ultimate victor. Don't be discouraged when it seems that we're losing. Don't be discouraged when it seems like the forces of darkness are spreading. Know that it will only be temporary. It will not last. The kingdom of this world is a kingdom divided against itself, and it cannot stand. Now, in the other letters, Jesus has various instructions for them. He tells them to do things like return, repent, remember. Here, he tells them one word, one instructional word. He only has one instructional, aside from do not. He only has one do, and that is be faithful. That is the instruction he has. Be faithful. In fact, be faithful unto death. Do not love your life more than you love my kingdom. Be faithful unto death. In the King James, it actually says remain faithful, which I actually like a little better, but we tend to use the ESV here, so that's all right. Remain faithful. Now, ultimately, that is our top goal in our life on this world as it pertains to ourselves. We are to glorify God. Ultimately, all things will. But as it pertains to what we need to do, the actions we need to take, ultimately, it all boils down to one thing. Be faithful. It is good to do good. It's great to stay cheerful in the face of trouble, studying your word and building each other up and witnessing, and those are all wonderful. And may the Lord help you all with doing each of those. But in the end, we have to stay faithful. All of those things are building with gold and building with silver and building with jewels, but the foundation, which is Jesus Christ, is to remain faithful. Hebrews 3 has this very stark warning. Take care, brothers, lest there be any of you an evil, unbelieving heart leading you to fall away from the living God. May that never be said of me or of any here. If you take nothing else from this letter, this is, in my opinion, the most important point. Without faith, it is impossible to please God, and that faith must be rooted in the redeeming work of Jesus Christ on the cross, and we must stay faithful. let's see here. Where are we at? Where are we at? Okay. Now, about this absence of resistance, notice what is not in this letter. He doesn't say, by the way, trouble is coming, so stock you up your food and your cash and your ammunition. He doesn't say, trouble is coming, run. He doesn't say, prepare yourself a fortified place in the hills. He doesn't say, get ready to resist and try to restore the government to what it should be. He says, be faithful. We have a tendency here in this country, but I'm sure it's happened in other places and other times before, to try to save this world, to try to redeem or restore this world. A noble sentiment, I'm sure. But remember that ultimately, or in the end, as we talked about, this world will not be saved. This world will be burned. This world will pass away. So don't get too caught up in that earthly resistance, I guess. There's a time to trade, to accept an earthly defeat in order to receive your heavenly reward. So bear that in mind. All right, let's wander into the swamp now. Okay, I can do it. Extrapolations. First of all, the problem of suffering. When reading about something like this, like, hey, you're about to suffer and then you're going to die, who here has ever asked themselves, why? Why would that happen, Lord? Why would you let that happen? Just me? Oh, you all are great. You all are firm in your faith. Well, I wonder it occasionally, and I have met other people who wonder it. In fact, it's got its own name. It's called the problem of evil. I will not get too much into that. I encourage you to study a branch of learning called apologetics that is all about explanations and answers. I won't say that it's something like, you know, don't be fooled that, oh, I've studied apologetics, so that makes me a better Christian or a higher-up Christian or something like that, but it is important for us to study and to learn and to know, and we can learn a lot by talking with brothers, some of them alive, some of them in our church, and some of them who've been dead for a long time but wrote down answers about things that we might wonder about. And in fact, I've never talked to anyone about Jesus or about the kingdom in an attempt to get them to salvation without them asking me, hey, how come bad things happen? It's called the problem of suffering. But in short, suffering and evil exist because we as humans choose to do evil. We can go a lot further into that, but essentially there's evil because we choose to do it. As a gross oversimplification, I'm going to say evil comes mainly from one of two things. Suffering in our lives, not evil, suffering in our lives comes from one of two things. Number one, it comes from our own evil deeds, and God allows it as a correction to us, as a trial or tribulation in order to correct that action. Paul said, because you all have abused the Lord's Supper, that's why some of you are sick and some of you have even died. I think he says falling asleep because of your sin. So suffering in our lives can come from our sin. So if you come into a trial, a fiery period, ask yourself, ask the Lord, Lord, is this because of something I've done? Is there something I need to correct? Ask a brother, ask a trusted brother or sister. Hey, brother, have you noticed something in me that needs to be pruned? And sometimes there is. And sometimes there's not. Sometimes we suffer because this is a fallen world. And that is hard because we want God to stop it now. Say, Lord, I haven't done anything wrong. Why am I suffering? Make this stop right away. In the end, whether the suffering comes from the fallen world or whether it comes from our own evil deeds, it's kind of irrelevant because both of them are the same thing, an opportunity for us to improve ourselves. We ought to be, as Paul, rejoicing in our suffering. When the fiery trial comes, we ought to be saying, hooray, a chance to improve myself. I am not there. Is anybody here there yet? Okay, good. Yeah. No, not good. I wish that you all were, but in my weakness, I'm glad it's not just me. I will make a brief aside about who here is old enough to remember or knows about something called the faith movement. Anybody here remember? Okay, there's a few. Okay, so the faith movement has as a part of it an idea that with enough faith, trouble can be thrown off. Sickness, poverty, any kind of tribulation can be cast aside through enough faith. And there are verses that support this, things like if you have the faith of a mustard seed, you can tell this mountain be removed, and the mountain will move out of the way. However, faith will not always alleviate suffering, nor should we want it to. That's kind of hard to hear, isn't it? And to that, I point to our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, who prayed in his extremity, "Lord, take this cup away from me, but," what did he say next? "Not my will, but yours be done." Now, I would say Jesus was not lacking in faith, but he was submissive to his Father's plan, and so should we be. If you are in trouble, and you proclaim in faith that this trouble will pass away, and it does not, don't be disheartened by that. Remain submissive and say, "Lord, your will be done." And by the way, don't expect the trouble to disappear when you say, "Lord, thy will be done." It might continue after that until the end of your life. And if it doesn't, I guarantee there are other troubles that will. In the instance of Smyrna, they seem to have no lack of faith. At the very least, Jesus does not reprimand them for any lack of faith. However, the trouble, the suffering is mellow. It is set to occur. Their role is not to cast it off by faith, but to profit through the suffering by staying faithful unto death and receiving their reward. Excuse me. And we're going to skip that. All right, the value of suffering. In short, we as people value what we struggle to achieve. The harder it is to achieve, the more we value it. What we struggle for, we have a lot of esteem for. Think about a marathon runner. Marathon runner, if he runs fast, he's hurting himself. He's really, when you're running for a long distance like that, you're basically killing yourself slowly. Some people say it's healthy. Those people are wrong. They're insane. But if you run that marathon and you get a slow time and someone else runs that marathon and hurts themselves more and gets a faster time, I don't know about you guys, I esteem, and society in general esteems, that fast time more because that person suffered more and they worked harder for it. Lifting more weight in competition, it's harder to do, but we esteem it more if you can lift more than someone else, don't we? Maybe that's just men. Maybe you ladies are above that. Think about the military. If you go up to the White House and the president says, "Hey, let's have some coffee," and he rings the bell or whatever, and the guy comes in and brings you some coffee, the guy who brings it in will be a Navy steward. There's actually a unit that works at the White House. I used to know the name of it. I've since forgotten. But the guy who comes in with the coffee will be a member of the Navy, and he'll be a steward. And if I was talking to him, and I said, "Hey, you were in the Navy. What'd you do in the Navy?" He said, "I served coffee at the White House." I'd say, "Okay." And I turned to this other guy, and I'd say, "Hey, you were in the military?" "Yeah, I was." "What did you do in the military?" "I was a Marine rifleman. I fought in Vietnam in the jungle." I would have more esteem for the Marine. Maybe that's just me, but I would say, this guy suffered. He worked harder, and I'll be honest, I have more respect for him because he went through the hard thing. His suffering, strange as it sounds, put it this way, his suffering added value to his experience. And I'm sure he would say the same thing. And the things that we esteem, not always, but quite often, the good things that we esteem come from the Lord. Remember that we were made in his image. There is nothing that we enjoy that is good, not when we enjoy sin, because we do that too, but the good things that we enjoy, he enjoys also. As he knows our suffering, he also knows our enjoyment. And so when we have that greater esteem for that thing that we suffered for, he has that greater esteem for it too, or so I extrapolate. And it seems to bear it out, because those here at Smyrna who are going to suffer before they die are going to receive that garland of victory. And in fact, we have the verse there at the top from Psalm 116, "Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints." And finally, sorry, I think I'll make it though, the fear of death. Who here is afraid to die? I'm afraid to die. I am not afraid of what comes after death. I have faith in my Lord. I am apprehensive about the act of dying. That part makes me nervous. This worthy church, the letter, this letter is about death. The opening and closing framing, it's about faith too, but it's also about death. The opening framing is the words of the first and the last who died and came to life. What's he saying? I've already conquered death. Have no fear of it, because I died and I came to life. I have conquered death. And how does he close it? The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. He opens and closes with these. I have conquered death. You no longer need to fear it. What a wonderful comfort that is. The second death is the lake of fire. For those of you who don't know, you can find that in Revelation 20 or 21. 20, I believe it's 20. You can find that in Revelation 20, where death and Hades are thrown into the lake of fire, and it quite literally says this is at the great white throne judgment. Oh, actually, I did write it down. Fantastic. This is the second death, the lake of fire. If anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. This is the final horrible end for those whose names are not in the book of life. This is the final horrible end for the devil and his demons. This is the final end for death and Hades to be cast in the lake of fire. But Jesus assures us, and he is the one who has conquered death, because as he tells us, I have died and come to life. Death does not have power over me. And he tells us, to you who overcome, you will not be hurt of this second death. And that are the words of the one who in Revelation 19:11 is called faithful and true. And I put down here at the bottom this verse from John. This is in the King James Version. It's parsed a little differently in the ESV. But I love that final sentence, or that final clause. If it were not so, I would have told you. Be comforted, because he has told us all that we need to know. If we needed to know more, he would have told us. That's all I have.
Very good. Thank you. I'm going to open it up for some discussion, questions, comments.